Many of us clearly have a desire to help people in need. That's obvious every time there's a major disaster and donations just flood into organizations like the Red Cross. And that may not be the best way to approach doing good for others. That's what our guest says. He studies this subject area and has a bunch of ideas and suggestions for how to spend our time and money, our volunteer time and money, better. William McCaskill is the author of Doing Good Better, Effective Altruism and How You Can Make a Difference. William McCaskill is an associate professor at Lincoln College, Oxford University. He earned a PhD in philosophy from Oxford and studied at Princeton under a Fulbright scholarship. Will is the co-founder of two nonprofits. Thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
You start with a cautionary tale. Tell us about the saga of the play pump.
The play pump seemed like an extraordinary innovation, and Bill Clinton even referred to it as a wonderful invention. It was a children's merry-go-round that would double as a water pump. So children would play on the merry-go-round, and in pushing the merry-go-round, they would pump clean water for the village. And it got a huge amount of investment, $18 million from USAID and the Case Foundation. Even Jay-Z backed it. But it was a terrible idea. It pumped less water than a typical hand pump, yet cost three times as much. The children of the village would get very tired, and so it would be up to the elderly women to push this merry-go-round, a task they found demeaning. And what's more, the communities of the village had never been asked, did they actually want this? And so after an investigation by UNICEF, they concluded that the flaws of the play pump far outweighed any potential benefits. It was then, thankfully, widely recognized that the program was a disaster, and it largely shut down.
So what is the lesson we learn from the story of the play pump?
The lesson is that good intentions aren't good enough. The people behind the play pump, the investors, the media that covered it, they all did genuinely want to do good. But because they weren't reflective, they weren't being effective. They hadn't done a research, they hadn't done investigations into whether this was actually a good idea or just something that appealed to the kind of excited emotions that you might get around a revolutionary new technology. And so the lesson is that if we want to do as much good as we can, we have to be kind of nerds. We have to look at the research. We have to be careful and reflective about how we're trying to do good.
So it's about tamping down the emotions a bit, it sounds like, to not get so caught up in, wow, that sounds really cool. Let's buy 1,000 of those.
Yeah, it's about harnessing the emotions. So if you see, for example, a natural disaster struck another country, and you think, oh, I just really want to help, that's absolutely terrific, and I think that motivation is admirable. But what effective altruism is about is then harnessing that emotion and putting it to make not just a difference, but to make the most difference you can, putting it towards wherever will do the most good.
And sometimes what will do the most good is truly surprising. And another example you give in the book right after the play pump example is you write about an organization called ICS that focused on school attendance and test scores, wanted to improve those, and discovered a bunch of things that didn't work before it found the stuff that did.
Yeah, so this was programs led by an economist called Michael Kramer. And he started to test different programs to improve education. And things that you thought would obviously work, like distributing textbooks, actually were found to have no impact. And what did work? This incredibly boring, very unsexy program called deworming. So it's not really known to us in the West, but intestinal worms affect over 1 billion people worldwide. And they're exceptionally cheap to treat. You can cure the 7 most prevalent forms of this disease for just 50 cents through mass deworming of school children. And when Michael Kramer tested this program, he found that not only was it a good health program, it was also one of the most effective ways to improve school attendance. And when these people were followed up with many years later, it was found that those who had been dewormed were working more hours and earning more later in life as well. So it was found to be one of the most effective health and development programs there is.
Which I think we've begun to catch on to in the United States. We figured out a few years ago that if we at least give breakfast to kids in school, they won't be falling asleep in class for a lack of nutrition.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in the case of deworming, people thought, well, it's unclear why attendance in poor countries is so low. Is it because they need to stay home and work with their families? It wasn't that clear. But it seemed like one big cause was just the kids were sick. They had intestinal worms that were making them lethargic. And for that reason, it was they weren't attending school as much as would be best.
And it's just incredible to think what a difference, though, that time can make. It adds up over time. And I think what the case reported was that there were something like two more weeks of attendance per student per year, which made a gigantic difference in how well they did in school.
That's exactly right. And then later on in life, they were working 10% more hours. They were earning 10% as much, 110% as much. So it made an absolutely phenomenal difference. And it just goes to show just how much power we have as members of rich countries to improve the lives of other people. Deworming is just one example. Through distributing bed nets that protect children against malaria, you can literally save a life for just a few thousand dollars.
Now, there's an example given about bed nets and the distribution of those, that after a while you end up giving bed nets to everybody if you have enough money, and then you have to start looking for other places. But this is, I think, one of the major thrusts of what you write about in Doing Good Better, is to make sure that you're having some effect.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, and it's harder than you might think to have any impact at all. In fact, when tested, 75% of social programs are found to have no impact at all. But even more importantly, within the 25% of programs that do work, the very most effective programs are far, far better than the ones that just make a difference. And so it's actually crucial to work out what's the very best and focus on that.
We will talk about how to get to those judgments when we come back to talk more with William McCaskill. His book is Doing Good Better, Effective Altruism and How You Can Make a Difference. Back with Will and you on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is William McCaskill. He has written a book about how we can spend our money and volunteer time to have greater impact on the people who we're trying to help. His book is called Doing Good Better, Effective Altruism and How You Can Make a Difference. You can join this discussion on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, William, in part, are you saying that we should be holding nonprofit and charitable ventures to the same standards as business, the same level of getting results?
Yeah, I think we may even want to hold them to higher standards. So with businesses, there's a feedback mechanism such that bad businesses die and good businesses flourish. The businesses that produce the best products, people can immediately see that's a good product. And so they'll want to buy more of that product and that business will flourish. In the case of charities, however, that's not the case. If you donate to a charity, you almost never hear about what exactly happened with that money. And so that's why we need to be very proactive in assessing just how much good is a charity doing and really demand for it to be very transparent and open about what it's doing.
Have some of the agencies that... Go ahead.
If a charity's raising money but taking money or attention thereby away from other charities that are doing even more good, that's a kind of unexpected way in which charities might be doing harm.
Has there been an effect on charities to bump up their game just a little bit through the likes of Charity Navigator, which at least gives you an idea of how much of their money goes to programs versus administration and marketing and things like that?
Charity Navigator has certainly been extremely influential, with its core idea being that the way you assess a charity is by looking at percentage spent on overheads. But I'm not sure that influence has been a good thing, because I think percentage spent on overheads is actually a pretty lousy way of assessing whether a charity is any good. If you've got a charity with a program that just doesn't achieve very much, then it'll still not very achieve very much if you're not spending very much on overheads. It's also a metric that's just very gameable. You can easily tweak your balance sheets in order to show that you have less overheads than you actually do, and so on. And that means, I think, a lot of people get distracted. They think, oh, well, this charity has low overhead, so it's good. Whereas much, much more important is the question, is this charity focusing on a highly effective program? Is it, what's the impact that that program has in terms of the number of people benefited and by how much they're benefited? And that makes a far greater difference between most charities than the percentage the charity spends on overhead.
And in the book, you point out questions we should be asking about how effective these charities are. But even before you get to that point, you talk about us in terms of the people thinking about giving stuff. You talk about the 1% and deconstruct the income graph for us. How do we do in income versus the rest of the world?
We in rich countries like the United States and the United Kingdom are exceptionally wealthy. Where, in global terms, it's like with aristocracy. So almost every member of the United States is in the richest 15% of the world's population, even once you take into account the fact that money goes further overseas. And if you're just on the typical income in the United States, that's $27,000 for a full-time worker. You're earning 40 times as much as the poorest billion people. Those are people living on 60 cents a day, or the equivalent of what $1.50 would buy in the United States. And if you think about that, that's what does $1.50 buy, like a bag of rice or something? Mm-hmm. So the scale of global inequality is really unimaginable. And so, you know, we talk a lot about the 1%, but when we think in global terms, you know, we are the 1%, or at least the 5%.
We have a call here from Caleb in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Will McCaskill. He's the author of Doing Good Better. Hi, Caleb.
Hi, Jeffrey. Good morning. Hi, Will.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And thanks to you, Will, for teleconferencing in and talking to our local community and our local radio station. Pretty neat opportunity from my vantage point anyway, to have you as a guest and for our local community to hear the premise of your message in your book. My question for you is about Rotary International. And just for the listeners who may not be familiar, I'll give a brief background. I'm a member of one of the four local Rotary clubs in Grants Pass. I'm the public relations chair for my club. I'm also active with human trafficking awareness and prevention efforts through Rotary. And Rotary clubs, just their purpose is for fellowship and networking, but also for service. That's the premise of our clubs. And so it's very much related to what you're talking about. And Rotary International, I mean, we're in 200 countries. We have over a million members. It's community leaders coming together to pool their financial resources and expertise. And our foundation does a lot of good work in the world and in our local communities. I believe we've been ranked in the very, very top tier of financial management of our funds, mm-hmm. and effectiveness. We have very specific uses for our funds in the world. We promote peace, we fight disease, provide clean water.
Caleb, I want to move you to a question here.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm the PR chair, so I'm a little promoting there. We have these specific purposes for our organization, but I'm wondering your familiarity with what we do and how we might do it better, and if there's areas of weaknesses in your exposure to Rotary that we should be focusing on to do our work better, because a lot of passionate Rotarians love what we do, but we can always improve. So what are your thoughts on our Rotary organization?
All right, thanks for that, Caleb. Appreciate it. Here, Will, here's your chance to tune up the Rotary.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm actually not that familiar with Rotary International, but it sounds like what you're doing is terrific. And I'm really happy that you're doing so well in terms of financial accountability and so on. But then I'd emphasize that's financial accountability and how well you kind of run internally is just one aspect. The second crucial thing is what programs you choose to focus on. And you said you did a few things on fighting disease and clean water. Within them, there are some programs that are exceptionally effective and some that are much less so. So for clean water, for example, digging wells, it's okay. It definitely does good. But you can do far more good again through donations, for example, to dispensers for safe water. These provide chlorine dispensers at source. And because the main problem with water is not actually access to water in particular, but just cleanliness of water. And chlorine dispensers at source are a very effective way of cleaning water so that people get sick less often. Similarly with disease, the very best sort of health programs like Against Malaria, Foundation distributing bed nets or deworming are considerably more effective than other sorts of health programs. And so again, the kind of places to look for identifying what program areas might be best would be GiveWell.org, which is an outstanding charity evaluator. And then if you want to go into even more depth again, the Poverty Action Lab, which assesses many different sorts of development programs and makes recommendations there too.
We're talking to William McCaskill. He's the author of Doing Good Better, Effective Altruism and How You Can Make a Difference. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Will, there are five questions you want us to apply, starting with how many people benefit and how much. You just gave us an indication of some places people can turn. But then you bring up a term I hadn't seen before, the QALY, the Q-A-L-Y. What is that?
So the QALY, or Quality Adjusted Life Year, is what it stands for, is a metric used by health economists in order to assess how much of a benefit is provided by different sorts of health programs. And it takes into account the two ways that you can benefit someone. One is to, you know, open scare quotes, save their life, namely that's extending someone's life, and extending someone's life by longer rather than less is generally better. And the second way to benefit someone is to improve their quality of life while they are alive. And so the Quality Adjusted Life Year takes into account both of those ways of improving someone's life. You can increase their health while they are alive, or you can get them to live longer. And one QALY is 1 year of very high quality health. And using that, you can compare all sorts of different health programs in terms of their impact.
If you go through this process, though, I mean, is it possible that the dollars end up piling up for the places that are seen as the most effective?
Well, what's really great is that this principle of maximizing cost effectiveness is self-correcting. So let's suppose that BedNets is the most effective program. Well, then you'll invest in BedNets until diminishing returns mean that it's no longer the most effective thing. Then you'll move on to the next most effective program. Perhaps that's deworming. And then you'll fund that until it's no longer the most effective thing as a result of diminishing returns. And so on and so on. And so you'll always put money towards wherever it will have the biggest benefit in terms of people's well-being.
Which leads to question two, which is this the most effective thing you can do? And how do you make that determination?
Yeah, so I have that question. Just, are we making a difference or are we making the most difference we can? And I put that in there because even within ways that do good, people often ask, well, is this program having an impact? It's not enough to ask that. You have to ask, is it making the most impact? So even within different sorts of education programs, for example, and between programs that really do make a difference, there's still a factor of 100 in terms of how much of an impact they're having. You know, in terms of additional days that children go to school, or in terms of improvements to test scores. Even between good programs, one can do 100 times as much as another.
All right, and question number three is this area neglected? And you give us the water versus diamonds value tale. What do we learn from that?
Yeah, so this is an old tale from economics. Which is more valuable, water or diamonds? And in one sense, of course, water is more valuable because if we didn't have water, we'd die. But then if you look at the price of water versus the price of diamonds, you know, diamonds are very expensive and water is very cheap. And the reason for that is because we already have a lot of water, at least in rich countries. And so the price of an additional gallon of water is very low. And that's relevant in a whole host of ways when it comes to doing good. Clearest example, in my view, is natural disasters. So obviously we should fund disaster relief. But the question if you're thinking about donating to a disaster relief is, how much good will my additional donation make? And the truth is that natural disasters already receive a very large amount of funding. And that means that your additional donation won't do nearly as much as if you direct that funding to very neglected areas like tuberculosis or malaria, ongoing natural disasters, where you can have an even bigger impact because the most effective opportunities still haven't yet been taken.
So in that particular example with the disasters, and there are a couple of you cite in the book that were big and widely reported and well-known and therefore got a lot of dollars and probably more than the Red Cross and the relief agencies could use. So is it simply a perusal of news items that lead you to look for things that might not be, you know, the front page disaster, but a place where there's need?
Yeah, it's of course hard to find those areas that's neglected. But as a rule of thumb, the ongoing conditions, especially within global health, so that means malaria, that means tuberculosis, that means neglected tropical disease like these intestinal worms, they don't get nearly as much news attention because they kill people every day, whereas natural disasters just occasionally kill large numbers of people. And so it's by focusing on those sorts of programs, like those recommended by GiveWell, that really enable you to have the biggest impact.
And then question number four of the five questions is what would have happened otherwise? And here you introduce us to a name most of us had never heard of, Viktor Zhdanov. What did he do?
So the eradication of smallpox was one of humanity's greatest ever achievements, I think. Smallpox in the 20th century killed more people than all wars, all political famines, all genocides and all terrorist acts combined. Yet we managed to eradicate it in 1973, saving over 60 million lives. And normally the acclaim goes to Donald Henderson, who ran the eradication campaign. He won many awards. But we have to ask, when thinking about doing good, if he hadn't existed, if he'd never taken this job, what would have happened? And the answer is someone else would have been in that job and doing, you know, very similar work. And smallpox would have been eradicated anyway. But if we go back a couple of decades, we see the original instigator of the smallpox eradication program, Viktor Zhdanov, without whom the program may never have even happened. So he came from the USSR to the World Health Organization, which was unprecedented at the time, and managed to convince them correctly that smallpox could be eradicated. This isn't something they thought possible at the time. And so it was by the force of his arguments and persuasive power that the eradication campaign went ahead. And without his actions, it's not clear that smallpox would have been eradicated even today. And so this, again, comes up very often when trying to do good, is to think not just what's the impact I'm having right in front of me, but even if I hadn't acted as I did, what would have happened? Because that's the difference I'm making.
So then we go from the story of the good intention and the good result to good intention and not so good result. And you identify the Scared Straight program to try to scare people away from crime as being in that category. What happens with that program?
Scared Straight is a program that tries to scare juvenile delinquents out of a life of crime by taking them to a prison and showing them around for a few hours, and the prisoners jeer at them and scream at them and taunt them. And this is actually a TV show. It's very popular. And it's been rolled out across prisons all over the country. But it's also been studied quite extensively. And the best guess from the basis of these studies is not even that it doesn't have an impact, but that it's actively harmful. So by taking juvenile delinquents and taking them to these prisons, they go on to commit more crimes than they would otherwise have done. One estimate actually put the cost to society at $230 for every $1 invested in the program. And that just shows crucially why we have to think about what would have happened otherwise. Because it's true that the juvenile delinquents go on to commit fewer crimes than they were committing before, but they're committing more crimes than they would have otherwise have committed, even if they had never gone through the program. And that shows how crucial it is to be looking at what are called randomized controlled trials, where you've got a control group and you've got an experimental group, and you're looking at the difference that your program makes, because otherwise you could even be doing harm, as Scared Straight is doing.
So, Will, when people think about places to spend their money and their volunteer time, I mean, would the result of what you're talking about in doing good better be an upending of where we're spending a lot of money and time now?
I think so. At the moment, we spend, in terms of our donations, an awful lot goes to the church, an awful lot goes to your alma mater, and an awful lot goes to local charities. And I think the far better giving opportunities involve fighting poverty in the poorest countries in the world, such as through global health, and then potentially some other causes as well. Criminal justice reform is one, immigration reform, factory farming is another, and certain sorts of political change as well. I think if we were to start following these principles, then the charitable landscape would change greatly indeed.
The book will really make you think, and then it'll make you think differently about how you pull money out of your wallet and time out of your life to do what you think is good. Will McCaskill is the author of Doing Good Better, Effective Altruism, and How You Can Make a Difference, just out from the publishers. Will, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thank you.
All right.